This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Digital voice assistants are proliferating as we become increasingly reliant on the internet in our daily lives. Those assistants listen to you and execute demands, but what are they doing with what they're hearing? Well, we get into that later in the program. First, the effects of an executive order issued by President Trump on Friday rippled around the world. And the U.S. as the U.S. borders slammed shut. That order suspended entry of all refugees to the United States for 120 days and blocked entry for 90 days for citizens of seven predominantly Muslim countries. The courts reacted quickly, issuing a stay of the order. Problems and questions continued through the weekend at international airports around the country, and protests flared at some of those airports. And that is sound collected at Charlotte Douglas International Airport over the weekend. And here to update us on what happened this weekend, what's happening now, are WFAE's David Borax and Nick DeLacanal. And Nick, you were at the airport, and that is your piece of audio right there. So tell us about the atmosphere at the airport, I guess, on Saturday and again on Sunday.
Right. Well, the first protest broke out spontaneously. By my count, there's about 60 protesters there. It started out small, about a dozen protesters. After that, there was a large group that joined, and some of the members of which were of Charlotte Uprising, which was the group formed in the wake of the Keith Scott shooting last year in September. They led some chants. At one point, there was, as best as I can describe it, maybe a skirmish or a scuffle. There was just a lot of pushing, and the result of which there were six protesters arrested. They were charged with trespassing, some with resisting arrest. Now, the majority of other protesters were there protesting Trump's latest executive order that temporarily bans immigrants from seven Muslim-majority nations from entering the U.S., which, as you mentioned, has been walked back or blunted by some temporary court orders and since walked back over the weekend by the White House.
Yeah. NPR described at one point over the weekend that the demonstrations at Charlotte's airport were more acrimonious than most. Were airport demonstrations fundamentally peaceful across the country?
As far as I've heard, yes. And it was acrimonious just for a moment there. Most of it was peaceful, I should say. Police did once there was a little bit of a disturbance, police did ask protesters to leave the airport. Some lingered for a while, and eventually they just kind of gathered right outside the terminal doors. It mostly dispersed by 10:30 p.m. So yeah, mostly it was peaceful.
There were – go ahead, David.
Nick, it sounds like it's very different from Sunday's protest, which was not actually at the airport itself. The organizers of that protest reached out to the airport folks to try and get a permit, and they were told you actually can't get a permit for a demonstration of this size at the airport. And that's right. It's a rule that was originally designed to keep down anti-management protests by unions at the airport. But in any case, they ended up out at the airport entrance off Wilkinson Boulevard, and there was a crowd gathered on this triangle of concrete out there, and they were very peaceful. There were people from all walks of life. There were a lot of Muslim American immigrants there, and they were there to talk about the issues, and they had signs saying no ban, no wall, and immigrants are welcome here. Mm-hmm. I talked to the organizers, and they said they just want to help bring together people to send the message that America is a welcoming country, that we're a nation of immigrants. And they also were very pointedly talking about the problems that they see with the law. I talked to one guy, Osama Tafili, who was protesting. He's a graduate student here. He has a student visa. He is here on a student visa and hoping to get a green card. He's at UNC Charlotte. And he doesn't believe that actually the president's executive order is going to prevent terrorist attacks. Let's hear what he had to say.
I mean, let's be realistic. Those terrorists who come in here, they're not from those countries only. If there is any of them came from those countries, they're from other countries. They could be Europeans, they could be Asian, they could be anybody. They could be American themselves. So I don't see how this ban, even for 90 days, is going to help secure the border for now.
Now, this order affects him potentially. It affects people that they know. His wife is an immigration lawyer, and she talked to me about an Iranian family that she knows. The husband, father is out of the country right now. he's not sure if he can come back. And, you know, immigration lawyers are telling people, check with a lawyer to see what your rights are here.
This executive order caused chaos around the world, at airports around the world, because of people boarding flights to come here, et cetera, and not being able to get on those airplanes. And then people stranded at airports in America at customs, on the other side of customs, who couldn't get in. I think I heard CNN report yesterday that at one point there were 109 people detained at airports around our country, any of them at Charlotte. That we know of?
No. Well, when I spoke to Aviation Director Brent Cagle, and this was, I mean, Saturday night, he said that to his knowledge, no one had been detained at the Charlotte airport. Some media outlets were reporting that one of the men detained at the JFK airport in New York was headed for Charlotte. He was from Iran. He, I think the report said that he worked for the military as an interpreter and was headed to Charlotte with his wife and three children to settle here, though.
Do we know how many people this impacts, not only this weekend because of the executive order and stranding people at airports, but overall people waiting to come in the next week or two or three or the next month or so?
Yeah, well, that's a good point. I mean, it's hard to tell exactly how many people are affected by this. The ACLU said 100 to 200 people were detained at airports, but yeah, that's not counting, like you said, the
well, there are tens of thousands who've been vetted already, and they're on there in various stages of the process.
Yeah.
You know, there are a million stories like that.
So the White House did walk back part of this later on in the weekend, saying that those with green cards could come in. But those who don't have them, who are in these situations at airports around the country, particularly I would imagine JFK in New York, what happens to those people? What has happened to those people? Are they just sitting on the other side of customs? Have they been put back on airplanes and sent back home? What's happening to those people?
There's one example of a guy at JFK who was put back on an airplane and sent back. I think he was going back to Iraq. And he a judge actually said ordered the government to do whatever they could to get the guy back here. And it was too late. He had already gone on his connecting flight. So there are examples of people who got all the way here and are going back.
And a lot of people who are employed in the United States, Silicon Valley's gotten on board with this because they have a lot of green card holders, et cetera, and other people who come in here to work and to consult are having a problem getting back in. And the president of Davidson College, Carol Quillen, issued a statement, I believe it was yesterday, about this.
You know, Mike, this really affects college campuses because if you think about it, we have a lot of visitors here and people here on graduate student visas and on green cards teaching at our colleges and universities in technical subjects and languages and other subjects. And so at Davidson, President Carol Quillen came out with a statement basically warning students and staff from the named countries in the executive order not to travel outside the U.S. until we know more about what's going on. And, you know, she actually picked up a quote from David Brooks, the New York Times columnist. We have a word for people who are dominated by fear. We call them cowards. I think she's gotten a lot of traction with that. But I live in Davidson myself, and I'm connected with the college, and I know people who are not sure they can leave the country right now. They're Muslim Americans.
Democratic Senator Charles Schumer says the administration didn't even check with the Justice Department to see if this executive order, and particularly the Muslim ban portions and the ensuing detentions, were constitutional. He says he believes they are not because religious tests aren't constitutional. What have we heard from other officers or officials about the constitutionality of this executive order? Anything?
I mean, well, President Trump has come out and said that this is not a religious test, that this is based on geography, just from these countries. It's not based on religion. But, I mean, it is worth noting that when he was campaigning, I mean, the campaign promise he made, and I quote, Donald J. Trump is calling for a total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States until our country's representatives can figure out what the hell is going on. So, I mean, originally this was based on religion, but now he's saying it's based on geography.
We tried to get 9th District Congressman Robert Pittenger to join us this morning, but he can't because he's getting on an airplane. But David Borax, you spoke to him over the weekend about the need for President Trump's executive order on immigration. And he said the president's concern about our borders and the people crossing them is warranted.
I think the president is warranted. It is on his watch for the security of this country. And as a result of what's happened the last 8 years of President Obama's very open border policy and lack of thorough evaluation of these individuals, these refugees, that we're having to go back and take a look and what's prudent, what needs to be done today.
Democratic Congresswoman Alma Adams represents North Carolina's 12th congressional district, and she joins us now for a few minutes to talk about this executive order and its impact. Congresswoman, thank you for joining us. I appreciate it.
Yes, thank you very much for having me. I'll be getting on a plane too, but I took the time to chat with you this morning, and thank you very much.
So what do you think about Robert Pittenger, what he just said?
Well, I think he's just going to support the president regardless of whether he does right or wrong. I think this was a very inhumane and sensitive thing to do. And I think you have to, as Mr. Schumer has said, you know, we have to consult. And I don't think there was any indication of really looking down the road as to what the impact would be, talking to the appropriate departments to see what the impact would be. And so we have all this chaos now breaking out. I think that we have a very rigorous screening process right now for refugees. And when the president has said that it is not about religion, well, all of these countries are Muslim countries. Hmm. So whether you've included all of them or whether you've included seven of them, those that are in the mix are Muslim countries. So I don't necessarily agree with that, but I think it's a hard
If most of the terrorist attacks that have been occurring in this country and around the country are associated with people who are followers of radical Islam, what would you have the president do to protect the country?
Well, I think that this process was very abrupt. I mean, I think we need to take a look at what we're doing, the screening process right now. From what I've heard, the departments that he wants to involve are really the same ones. I'm not sure what additional things he wants to do, but I think that should have been talked out, discussed, vetted, and I don't think he's done that. I think it was just a knee-jerk kind of reaction.
Elsewhere in Congressman Pittenger's comments that we didn't play on the air, he said that what we're doing is paying the price for President Obama's lax approach to keeping our borders secure. I know that you don't see it that way, but do you understand his point of view at all?
No, I don't. I do not understand his point of view at all, and I just don't think I don't think he's accurate in that. I think President Obama took appropriate steps. I think he did freeze. He did put a ban, but it was not as extensive. It did not hurt people in the way that this ban does. I haven't heard anything positive that has come out of Congressman Pittenger's mouth that's been positive about President Obama, so I don't expect to hear any now. Hmm. But, you know, I think we need to look at the impact that this has had on people. The refugees who are in our country go through extensive vetting right now. They pass a series of security screenings and all these things. So I hope that we can come to some kind of – plus, I really don't think that this is constitutional, and I hope that we're able to resolve it very quickly.
I don't know how much more time I have with you. I have to go to a break in about 45 seconds. Can you stay with us through the break for a few more questions?
Well, I've got to go to the airport. I can stay for a few minutes.
Okay, that's all. Just a few more minutes. We have Congresswoman Alma Adams with us from North Carolina's 12th congressional district. I want to point out that we invited also Senator Tom Tillis to join us, and he could not be with us this morning because he didn't respond to our request. We're coming right back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Tyndall Subaru Gastonia, featuring the new Outback with EyeSight safety technology that sees problems and initiates action to help avoid trouble. Details at TyndallSubaru.com. Charlotte has known about its shortage of affordable housing for many, many, many years, and there have been plans to put a dent in that. But following the protests last fall, the city set new goals for addressing those concerns. First, there was a 5-year timeline. Now they want to have 5,000 affordable housing units available within 3 years. But state law prohibits the city from imposing any affordable housing quotas. And there are other stumbling blocks as well. So what can be done? We hear some ideas tomorrow on this program at 9.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, Mexico and President Donald Trump collide. What now? We'll take it on in our 100-day spotlight. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
Join On Point from 10 to noon following Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the president's executive order on Friday, which led to chaos at airports around the world and certainly around the country, along with protests and demonstrations at airports, including our own here in Charlotte. And we're talking at the moment with Democratic Congresswoman Alma Adams, who represents North Carolina's 12th congressional district. You issued a statement about the president's order over the weekend, Representative Adams, calling it mean-spirited and inhumane. And Benjamin Witz, who is a senior fellow in governance studies at the Brookings Institution over the weekend, said the malevolence of President Trump's executive order on visas and refugees is mitigated chiefly and perhaps only by the astonishing incompetence of its drafting and construction. And he calls it incompetent because it wasn't checked out with other federal departments. Do you see it as being incompetent, or is this just an example of new administrations coming in and being inexperienced and not really knowing what the process is?
Well, I don't believe they don't know what the process is. I think they're ignoring the process. But you would think that his advisors, since we say that the president has no political experience, that he has no military experience, that hopefully he's got people working with him who know better. And if they don't know better, they should know better. And they should have been checking and interacting. And, you know, and I think you have to always look at the ramifications of the decisions that you make and what the fallout's going to be, what the impact's going to be. And they really did not do that. And I'm not sure why that happened. But certainly I think he has enough advisors. He should. To steer him in the right direction and to at least check out these things before they take this kind of really drastic action.
You have also said that this ban will do nothing to improve our safety. You're not alone in that sentiment, but why do you feel that way?
Well, you know, I think it's going to just create additional problems. We don't have any evidence that these are the folks who are creating the problems. And I think you're going to, you know, I talked with one lady yesterday when at the protest, who a Muslim American, who indicated that her husband doesn't even want her to go out dressed anymore as Muslim because he's so afraid. People should not. So I think you're gonna have increased fear. You're probably going to have folks who want to harm us, to even harm us more because of this ban and the fact that we don't seem to we're sending a message that we are not sensitive to people, that we don't care about people of that faith, and I think it's going to be a series of problems as a result of it. I don't think it's really going to protect America. I think it's going to create more problems and more hostility even within our country and outside of our country as well.
Democratic Congresswoman Alma Adams represents North Carolina's 12th congressional district. She joined us by phone. Thank you very much for being with us this morning. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. And we also reached out to Tom Tillis. We reached out to another congressperson as well, and they did not return our phone calls. And I want to thank Nick DeLacanal and David Borax for joining us as well in this segment. Thank
you. You're welcome, Michael. Thank you.
Well, most of us have become, if not comfortable with, then resigned to our digital footprint being observed as we surf the web, send and receive emails and text messages, and make phone calls. Perhaps that's why there is a certain amount of excitement about and even a welcoming of digital assistants. After all, they started on our phones with Siri, OK Google, and Cortana, but now they're moving into discrete boxes like Amazon Echo or Google Home. Now, these boxes are listening for your every command to find information, dim the lights, adjust your thermostat, play music, and more. But the key word there is listening. These boxes are listening all the time. What's happening to what they're hearing? How concerned should we be? Are these things wolves in sheep's clothing? Another example of our technology keeping tabs on us, or just a simple trade-off of privacy for convenience? We talk about that with Tim Moynihan and Michelle DeMoy. Tim has been on this program before. He's staff writer for Wired, where he covers hardware for Gadget Lab, and he joins us from New York. Good morning. Welcome back.
Hi, Mike. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And Michelle DeMoy is director of the Privacy and Data Project at the Center for Democracy and Technology, where she advocates for data privacy rights and protections in legislation and regulation. Good morning and welcome to you.
Good morning, Mike. Thanks for having me on.
You're welcome. Tim, let me start with you because you're the gadget guy. For those who may not know what we're talking about, what are these digital assistants? What do they look like? What do they do?
Most of them look like little tubes, and the important thing to know about them is that they don't have that much processing power built within them. They require a connection to a server, so a web connection, and then all the processing of what you're asking them to do is done there and then sort of sent back over a web connection.
But in terms of – if you ask one of these assistants to look up the capital of Alaska – it's going to do precisely what a Google search does, right?
That's right. Yeah. So the thing about these devices is that there are two phases for them, really. One that you mentioned is a listening mode, and believe it or not, that is sort of the less freaky outy part of them. The listening mode sort of it's keyed into those sort of magic words to wake them up, establish a web connection, and then send your data. Nothing when it's listening, so when it's at rest and you're not making queries, it's not recording you at that point.
How do we know that?
That's a great question. Well, even if they were, according to Amazon and Google, they are encrypting all that voice data. And what I would consider a tip-off as they're not actually recording you is that you can go online. You can go to your Amazon account or your Google account, and you can get a running list of everything it has recorded. And at least according to Amazon, there are strict regulations for its own devices and also third-party devices, which is another huge thing that we should talk about later, that they are not recording anything other than those things that are saved to the server.
So in that, the listening mode is the least creepy thing, you said, that these things are doing. What's the creepy thing?
Well, the creepy thing is that they are recording, you know, your voice when you're asking it to do anything. But then again, if you go back and listen to the things that it's recording, it sounds a little bit more alarming than what the reality is to me. It's basically like Google capturing your web searches. So there is a crumb trail. But I think the nature of these devices is that you're not really you're not doing things online that are as, you know, risky as you know, your Google search being opened up to other people.
Hmm. Well, you know, Michelle, all of us who have regularly interacted with computers or smartphones over the years have been leaving these digital footprints everywhere we go. How is what we're leaving behind by using these gadgets, these devices, any different, or is it any different?
Well, it's a little bit different in that, you know, we're talking about devices that are in our homes. And increasingly, of course, that's the case. And they're in our homes, they're in our cars, they're in our schools even. And so, they're like you mentioned, that there are crumbs sort of about us everywhere. And what's happening is companies are taking information from lots of different sources. And, of course, if you're a company like Google, you have lots of different ways to get that. You know, you can get it from YouTube, you can get it from Chrome, and from Android devices. And so all of that's being combined, and for the most part, it's being used to look for patterns. So when in the case of an audio device, it's looking for patterns to make the voice recognition software better and more accurate. But at the same time, this is a product, right, that is paid for by data. And so it's looking for information about you so that it can send you targeted advertising. And sometimes that's okay, and sometimes people are okay with it. I think some of the problem is that, you know, voice is a huge departure from what we're used to. You know, we're used to controlling our devices with touch. And this is an entirely different way of interacting with a machine. And I don't think it's very clear to people how much information is being kept, how it's being used. I think the opacity of all of the data collection is a problem.
But, you know, Apple iPhone users have had Siri for years. People who have Android phones have had Google. Microsoft now has Cortana. You can talk to all these devices. They'll send you back search results. Some of them do other things better than others. How is this different from having a phone in your pocket, which also has to be listening for you to say, okay, Google or Siri, tell me this. It has to be listening. How is this different? And you're carrying that in your pocket everywhere you go.
Right, right. And sleeping next to it. I always remind people that these are small tracking devices and not your friend. And I think we have almost personal relationships with our devices at this point. I think the difference is that an audio recording device is in the background, right? You may have your phone with you, and you probably have some understanding that the phone is with you. I think the sort of way that these audio devices fade into the background by design is part of maybe their appeal to some people, but it's also part of the privacy question, which is, do people understand that some of this information is being recorded, it's being, you know, matched across devices, and it's being used to profile you for different, you know, advertising or different products and services. And what that means then is that what you see online might be different from what I see online. And when you're of a different community, if you have different race or ethnicity, these things start to come into play. And I think that's where there's a problem, not just from privacy, but also from a community standpoint.
Well, the price of an Amazon Echo or a Google Home device is not where the real money is for these companies that are producing this. I think one of you alluded to this a minute ago. The real money is going to come from gleaning as much information about us as these devices can, and then using that information to make money. They're making money by, what, targeting ads to us?
I think that's the big part. You know, that's probably the biggest way that they make money. I think they're also building new products and services that are looking for ways to make money. So it's a little bit about advertising, and it's a little bit about research and development and looking forward, you know, 3 to 5 years to make sure that the company is monetizing and keeping up. And again, the way that all of our devices are tracked now, you know, I think that's really unclear to people. So it may just be advertising, but it's also, you know, what kind of content, right, that you see online. Increasingly, there are plugins and other software that track you across different websites, and that might be from Facebook or other social media. And again, I don't think it's entirely clear to people that when you're going online and surfing, there's almost always an entity that is aware of where you're going and recording that somewhere.
Talk to me about this, Tim, because she has called them, Michelle DeMoy has called these smartphones small tracking devices. Mm-hmm. And I believe since 2010, every car manufactured can be tracked using its GPS. We're being followed. We're being a roadmap of our daily progression through the world is being kept, isn't it?
Yes.
Is that scarier than the just the privacy invasion of these voice boxes that we ask questions of?
I'm a little freaked out by all of it. And I think, you know, this started a long time ago, as Michelle was mentioning. You know, browsers are tracking you, social networks are tracking you. I feel like, you know, here in the States, it's been less of a public concern than overseas. I know in Europe, you know, things have happened where, you know, they've sort of raised the issue that, like, this is not okay. But I feel like, you know, something like the Echo, it's weird. And you mentioned this, that it's like there's sort of this understanding that if you're not paying for a product, then you are the product kind of thing. But these are products that you're actually paying for, mm-hmm. right? These are products that I guess you're not paying for the service that they offer, but you're actually paying money for things that may sort of raise eyebrows in terms of privacy. In the grander scheme of things, I don't think things like the Echo or the Home are as much of a privacy issue as things like your laptop or as you mentioned, your smartphone. Those have a lot more data moving through them that can sort of track you and know where you are, what you're doing at any given time. And I think that the only thing you can really tell with one of these devices is whether you're home or not, which is also
Well, I don't know if I agree with that, actually, because I feel like audio data can reveal things. You know, ambient noise can kind of determine whether which room you're in. You know, background voices could sort of reveal people that you're with. So I think in some ways audio data is a little bit different. It's maybe more nuanced.
And you mentioned patterns, and I guess patterns are being used. Algorithms are being used to detect patterns in our behavior, so that they can better serve us and more quickly serve us with the information we're searching for by almost anticipating what it is we want before we even finished asking the question. But these patterns can also be used by law enforcement. For instance, I understand, and this has nothing to do with Alexa or Google Home, but these new smart electric meters have been used forensically to determine whether or not somebody was home, whether they're using a lot of electricity all of a sudden that may have contributed to a crime or whatever. We're leaving these little footprints. We can't hide from anything anymore, correct?
Yeah.
Well, I think from a privacy advocate standpoint, the answer is probably yes, although I will say that there are ways to control some of the data collection. It's not perfect, and it's not all-encompassing, but there are settings that you can use to turn off, you know, for example, your microphone, or to turn off the Google prompts for Siri, things like that. There are ways to sort of control it, and I think it's important for people to understand that anything that is happening online is not private for the most part.
But when you turn off these prompts, when you are saying, no, you can do this, but you can't do that in an Apple phone or an Android phone or on your computer, whatever, you're crippling what it can do for you. You're removing appendages from this device, and therefore it's not as useful, right? Is it worth the trade-off?
Yeah.
Are we overly concerned?
Well, there's a couple of things specific to these devices that illustrate that point. One is that if you turn off recording on your Google Home, it just doesn't work. Right? So you think you're taking this protection against, like, oh yeah, it shouldn't be recording everything I say. And then when you do that, because of the way these devices work right now, they require web connection. They require all that stuff to be offloaded to a server and sort of processed and come back to you. It's like, okay, yeah, you can control this, but then it doesn't work. And then, you know, on the back end, you can, you know, delete everything that you've ever, you know, said from your account. But, you know, it's an open question as to whether that data still resides somewhere.
I mean, Michelle, you mentioned the privacy issue of having these things record us and maybe recording the ambient noise in the background or something, some other conversations in the background. Once we say, Alexa, it starts recording. So unless you're committing a crime, should we be concerned?
I think in general, people should be vigilant. And I don't actually put the distinction on whether you're committing a crime or not. Of course, government law enforcement is attracted to these kinds of devices and the data that they can offer. But, you know, we have a due process in this country that comes first. And I think the privacy of what you say and do in your home is something that's protected. And whether or not that includes digital devices and services is still sort of an open question. But from our standpoint, protecting yourself is smart, and preempting any kind of ability for a government entity or other kind of entity to take this information and make inferences about you, which is really essentially what they're doing, that's something that you can control to a certain extent, whether or not it's that you don't buy this, which isn't ideal, but maybe you don't buy this, or you buy maybe a dumber version of a assistant device, or you actually consider the different connections that are going on. I think this is one thing that people maybe fail to recognize, which is you might have a smart thermostat, you also have a smartphone, you also have
Me stop you there because we have to take a break, Michelle. We'll come back to it in a second. Michelle DeMoy, Director of Privacy and Data Project. We're coming right back. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and McGay Shepherd, CFP, with the Shepherd Wealth Management Group at Stifel, dedicated to educating clients using a holistic personal financial planning approach, helping individuals navigate the investment landscape. McGayShepherd.com. And Sanger Heart and Vascular Institute, a part of Carolina's healthcare system, offering comprehensive healthcare, or heart care rather, including the region's only minimally invasive heart bypass option and heart transplant center. Well, the ramifications of President Trump's executive action on immigration continues to be a topic of conversation, and it will be with On Point with Tom Ashbrook in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock. Refugees to national security and the huge backlash the orders triggered over the weekend. All topics for discussion coming up.
We're at the beginning of a new chapter in history.
Donald Trump has said his priority as president is going to be protecting jobs.
Well, now let's take a step back and hear about the direction national security might take in the Trump administration. I'm joined
to understand the people and the policies that will shape the country for the next 4 years and beyond. Listen every day.
News matters. Stay connected at 90.7 WFAE, at WFAE.org, and with our mobile app.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about these digital assistants that are now proliferating in addition to Siri and Cortana and OK Google on our smartphones. We're talking about this with Tim Moynihan, staff writer for Wired, and also Michelle DeMoy, director of the Privacy and Data Project at the Center for Democracy and Technology. I had to interrupt you, Michelle, in the middle of a thought, and you were talking about how, you know, we now have smart thermostats, we have smart refrigerators. All these things are connected on the Internet of Things and can be operated by various devices. And your point was?
Well, as Tim mentioned, all of this is connected by the Internet, right? All of this is going to a cloud somewhere and being analyzed and mingled and married together. And so I think the expectation of the average user might be that this is not happening, that, you know, these are separate devices used for different reasons. And I think it's important for people to understand that these are actually connecting and talking to each other many times.
Now, there's one good thing that we know for a fact about the Amazon Echo, because John on Twitter writes, "The irony is that I'm listening to this discussion through an Amazon Echo." So that's a very good thing. But are these digital assistants really the first wave of artificial intelligence? And whenever we talk about artificial intelligence, particularly in the context of science fiction, it becomes very frightening very quickly. Is this the first wave? Is this the speeding train heading toward us?
I think it's a medium that's doing the same thing that other things have done in a different way. I mean, I think the first wave of artificial intelligence is probably something like, you know, Google autocomplete, where it just knows sort of what you're going to type a query on based on like a few letters. This is sort of spinning it out into a new realm, I think, and it's one that can be incredibly convenient, but, you know, obviously people need to be aware of the privacy concerns here. The thing to me is that it's a first wave of AI that is it's meant to build on the entire concept of AI. Like, as Michelle mentioned, all this data is sort of being remixed and sort of analyzed by computers to sort of make the entire system better. And that's sort of the beauty of it, but also the thing that makes all this data collection necessary and a little bit freaky.
And you say that both Amazon Echo and Google Home, and there are a few other boxes too, but you say that they're going to get smarter, a lot smarter. Is that because they're listening to us and becoming sentient beings, or because of what's happening with the underlying infrastructure?
It's the underlying infrastructure. It's the fact that, you know, their brains actually reside on some server somewhere, and it's a huge network of computers that you know, both of these companies have invested a lot of money into being on the forefront of. Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, you don't have to update your device continuously. It's just sort of magically happening in the background, where over time it should get better and better and better.
We know that our smartphones can be hacked, and that people, if they know how to do this, can turn your microphone and your camera on your smartphone, and you would never be the wiser. And we know that some very prominent people within the tech industry, and I think it may be Mark Zuckerberg at Facebook, covers over the camera on his computers and does something with the microphone to turn it off. Not because he thinks that Siri or Facebook is eavesdropping, but he's worried about hacking. Can these devices, Alexa, Google Home, can they be hacked so that somebody could be listening to us all the time?
Well, from my perspective, yes.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Tim.
Yeah, I would just say anything is possible in that realm. I will say that Google and Amazon have pretty fairly good strict security stuff. Where I think it sort of gets a little bit more worrying is that Amazon has sort of opened up its Alexa API. So you can – developers who are making their own products, be it a startup or a larger company, can put this service on other devices. And they have sort of guidelines and a review process for devices that aren't made by Amazon that have these things on them. But when you start branching out and putting multiple avenues into that service, then I think you get a little bit more worried. It's a smaller company that has like five guys working on a product where security or privacy isn't their main concern. They can build a device that gets to market pretty quickly. But, it might open the door for, somebody nefarious just tapping into it. Like, the Mirai bot that recently happened, that was aimed at IoT devices. Mm-hmm. It wasn't aimed at computers. So, there are multiple avenues here to be concerned about. And I think we're sort of talking about the same thing on two different realms, one being what are these large companies and possibly government entities doing with this information? And then what are other people going to be doing with it?
Well, one of you mentioned a few minutes ago that if you do a Google search using your voice on an Android phone, Google keeps a recording of that, a copy of that recording, and it goes into your account. And you can go into your account on the Google website, because I've done this, and you can hear every recording ever made that you've ever made. So if you say, what time's this restaurant closed, Google? And it will tell you, but that recording is in your account. Why? Why is that recording kept? You can get rid of it. You can erase it in terms of you not being able to see it anymore. But that doesn't mean that they've erased it. But why do they keep it in the first place? Why do phone companies keep a record of every outgoing and incoming phone call? Why? Why does your internet service provider keep a record of all the websites that you visited? Why? Why?
Well, I will say that part of it is what Tim mentioned before, which is, they're looking for patterns. They're looking for, especially in the audio recordings, they're looking for voice recognition patterns that can make this your speech more clear to the computer and vice versa so that you're getting more accurate information. On a bigger picture, though, I agree with your question, which is why are they kind of hoarding so much information about us? And I think there's almost this fear, I think, in tech companies that especially technology companies, that if you delete or get rid of some data, somehow you will be missing some secret sauce or some way to monetize or create revenue from this data. When in fact, there have been studies that have shown only a very small percentage of the data that's kept by companies is actually monetized and made into revenue. And so I think in some ways there's just this, the big data revolution, the advancement of automated computing and AI have made companies feel like, well, we need to hold on to this because at some point it may be valuable, when in fact I think that's not the reality.
But back in the day when you had to make when you pick up the phone and you would literally take your finger and stick it in the hole and dial a long distance number, you got charged by the minute for that number. So there was a reason for Bell Telephone to keep a record of that call. Long distance is free now. So why keep a record of that call? Why keep a record of my local calls? Why do they do it? Why? Is there a law that says they have to? Because law enforcement wants access to it if they need it?
I would assume that is part of it. I think, in a lot of cases they're doing it because they can. And that as Michelle alluded to, they're looking for future avenues of profit, which is sort of the scary thing.
So but people think we have a right to privacy, and I'm not sure that I don't think that's in the Constitution, but do we have we sort of said to the world, I want what this smartphone can do for me. I want what Alexa can do for me. I want this. And so I don't care about the privacy issues. Take that away. Use it as you will. Just give me what I want.
I think most people would probably agree with that sentiment. And in fact, surveys and polls have shown that people really care a great deal but feel very powerless. And I think that that's fair. You know, the settings and all of the different ways in which you can control this are difficult. They're not, you know, intuitive. They're not easy. Sometimes it requires reading a privacy policy that was not written for a normal person. And I do think the laws in the United States are in great need of updating. We have a very sectoral privacy law landscape where different types of data are protected, but only in a context. So, you know, HIPAA, for example, protects health data, but in a very narrow context of covered entities. You know, financial information is covered, but in very narrow context. I think that understanding is maybe not entirely clear to people, for example, who use fitness trackers. They may not understand that none of that information is covered by law. It's not protected in terms of privacy. And so, we at CDT have advocated for a baseline privacy legislation. We are one of very few countries that doesn't have just basic protections for privacy, and I think it's time that we did that.
Well, the Fourth Amendment prevents law enforcement, for instance, from unjustifiably searching a home. But there's also something called the third-party doctrine, which allows police to access information voluntarily shared with a third party. That third party, in this case, would be your bank or your phone company. And now, Amazon through Alexa, Google through Google Home, and hello, okay, Google. Do you think people are aware of this? I mean, has this been used against consumers who have opted into using these devices? That because you've told Amazon something, then the law enforcement can go after that without a search warrant?
Yeah, go ahead.
And I was just going to say that there was that murder case in Arkansas where they I think Amazon, there was a warrant issued and Amazon complied with some of it, but they sort of made it known that we're not recording everything in the home. Maybe you can find a timeline out of a crumb trail of when this guy was home, when he wasn't. But yeah, I guess Michelle can probably take it from there.
I think companies are under a lot of pressure right now to comply with law enforcement, especially when national security is invoked or terrorism. You know, an example of this would be the Apple FBI case from last year, where there's this tension between, you know, law enforcement having a legitimate need and want to get into a device to get information, and a tech company wanting to protect the security and the privacy of their users through encryption. I think this tension is incredibly hard for tech companies in particular because they have no interest in, violating the privacy or security of their users, really. It's not in their business interest. And so to have that kind of, to have to come out and say, you know, we want to protect the phones through encryption for lots of good reasons, it almost makes them appear to be supporting terrorism when, of course, that's not the case. And so I think these questions are being litigated all across the country, and I think, there's no clear-cut answers for what the balance is. We think the balance should tilt in favor of consumer privacy.
So we have two opposing concerns from listeners on Twitter and through email. Andrew on Twitter says, "I'm not concerned. Our social media sites do the exact same thing, but through text. Even smart TVs are listening. If you're buying these devices, know what you're buying and look into the terms and service." Yes, some smart TVs even watch you. Your cable company knows when you play back whatever's on your DVR. And if you use Netflix, they know what you're watching and where you stopped and where you want to resume. And people are not concerned about that. Maybe they shouldn't be. Who cares what I'm watching on television? Rick emails, "Can your guests offer advice on how to better protect ourselves from our technology?" So how can they? Turn everything off? Don't use it?
Well, there is a little bit of that. There definitely is a little bit of that. When you're talking about these devices, there are manual microphone off switches, right? So you lose a little bit of convenience because the whole point of them is that you can shout across the room, Alexa, what's the recipe for meatloaf, and it'll tell you.
Right.
But if you're really, really concerned about, okay, what's happening when this is not awake, there is a manual turn the mic off switch. The thing that's sort of not known yet is that, you know, all these third-party devices that will have Alexa on them, will they be as secure as, you know, Amazon purport says that the Echo is?
Yeah.
There is sort of movement in there. And I feel like the more things that are interfacing the web, the more features a device has, the more of a privacy concern it's going to be.
So are these digital assistants, these discrete boxes, Amazon Echo, Google Home, et cetera, are they any better or substantially different from their smartphone-based versions or just more convenient? Tim?
I would say that they're used in different ways. For me, it's I have Echo. I don't use it all that much, but I use it for things like when I'm in the morning, I ask it for the weather. I ask it, you know, what the news is. I, of course, ask it to play WFAE.
if you ask Echo for the news, it gives you NPR, doesn't it?
Yeah. It does a rundown and you can sort of customize that.
Damn fine thing.
Yeah. So for me, it's I never use the voice assistant in my phone, ever.
Really?
And because I think it's probably an illusion, but it's sort of private space, public space type stuff. I feel like when you're in your home, you can sort of talk to a cylinder on your coffee table, whereas in public, I'm not going to ask my phone anything.
Well, you're the privacy advocate, Michelle. Do you use any of these devices? Do you use Siri or Cortana or Google, or do you use Alexa, et cetera? Do you use them?
No, I don't.
Why not?
How
do you survive?
Somehow I limp along in life without a virtual assistant. I am totally not against technology at all. In fact, I think a lot of these are wonderful, and some of the science behind them is amazing. But my concern is, again, just the lack of protections for a lot of this really sensitive personal information. And I'm somebody who works in this field, and yet it's incredibly difficult to understand how much they're collecting, where it's going, how it's being used. You know, when you talk about artificial intelligence and systems like that, what you're really talking about is computers learning based on what humans tell them matters. So, you know, human beings are creating algorithms that kind of spit out content for us and advertising for us, but the human beings are the ones who are saying this data matters, this doesn't matter. And again, when you talk about equality, you talk about civil rights and what that means online, that's when I get really concerned about what content I'm seeing versus what content you're seeing and the implications of this as more and more of our lives go digital.
So Michelle DeMoy is Director of the Privacy and Data Project at the Center for Democracy and Technology, and Tim Moynihan, Staff Writer for Wired. Tell me this, Amazon Echo costs about $180, Google Home about $130. Which is the better deal in 10 seconds or less?
Best deal, I think, for entry-level stuff would be the Amazon Dot, which is $50.
Okay, and that connects. It does the same thing, correct, as the Echo?
Same thing.
Okay.
Same thing.
Thank you both for joining us. I appreciate it. Be afraid. Be very afraid.